Back together again, you and I, midweek style, Wednesday, the 10th of May, 2023, on Connecticut Today. We welcome back nationally known immigration attorney Renata Castro to talk about the impending end of Title 42 at the U.S. southern border and to get her thoughts on the overall state of the American immigration law system. Hearst Connecticut Media columnist and senior editor Dan Haar joined us for his weekly check-in. Okay, let's talk about what you're going to hear about tonight into tomorrow for the next few weeks, the removal of Title 42 at the U.S. southern border. You will see a lot of people trying to get in. What's going on with that? Political headache and otherwise even a logistical situation for the folks, the fine men and women who protect our southern border and members of the Border Patrol. There are military people down there as well. We welcome back, when we have topics like this, attorney Renata Castro, founding member of the Castro Legal Group, a full-service immigration firm. She represents a wide variety of clients, from accomplished athletes and individuals to investors, victims of domestic violence, as they seek a new life in the U.S. Online, it is Castro Legal Group. Check out Castro Legal Group online. And Renata's here. And Renata, hi. It's good to have you back. How are you?
It's great to be here again. Although the circumstances are testing my cardiac health.
Okay. Renata, what's going to happen tomorrow? A lot of people hear Title 42, right? And they kind of know what this is. Trump did it. It actually originated a few decades ago. So walk us through this.
Sure. Title 42 allows the U.S. government at any given time to limit entry into the United States by any individual who may pose a health risk to the society or to the community in the United States. Trump invoked this power during the pandemic to further limit access to the United States by those entering through the U.S. border. Now that the execution of Title 42 ends per the Biden administration, all that it means is that the United States will have to vet the entrance of these individuals seeking asylum protection merely as a result of the application of immigration law, which means whether or not these people pass what's called a credible fear interview, which establishes that they are eligible or not to pursue asylum protections in the United States. So it's going back to business as usual. However, it doesn't feel like that because the volume of individuals going through Customs and Border Patrol at the border is at an all-time high because the United States is doing a better job at patrolling our borders.
So, Renata, if somebody approaches the border tomorrow and they claim asylum, they want to come across, walk me through and walk my listeners through what happens if that person has some sort of what looks like credible ID, and then again if they don't. What are those two scenarios? How does that work?
If an individual comes to the border and passes through what's called a credible fear interview, which means that they fear for their lives as a result of persecution related to their race, religion, national origin, because they have a certain political opinion or because they belong to a particular social group that is persecuted in their home country, this person will enter the United States legally. The government allows them the opportunity to fight their asylum case while in the U.S. They are able to work, to pay taxes, go to school. They are an integral part of American society, working and contributing until their case is decided, which may take up to 12 years. Now, if an individual is found not to go to meet the minimum standards of a credible fear interview, this individual can choose to appeal their decision, which will likely mean that this person will stay in an immigration jail fighting their case, or this person is sent back to their home country or back to Mexico if that's where they came from. Not came from physically, but if that's their place of residence or nationality.
The state of Connecticut currently has, I think at last check, about 100 to 125,000 migrants here in the state that are undocumented, that are here, not through the usual legal process. Might that increase over the next few days? Who knows? Or months? Are one of our immigration experts that we turn to from time to time is with us, attorney Renata Castro. It's CastroLegalGroup.com. She's a nationally known expert on immigration law. Now, Renata, what did I read a couple of days ago? That Mexico has agreed to take in, I believe, refugees or migrants from four countries if they're turned away by the U.S.? What's the deal with that?
So it is important to know that the United States is trying a more holistic approach, working with other countries to avoid individuals from entering the United States. So some individuals are able to be go through the processing abroad of their asylum claims, but this is not going to help at the level that the United States would like it to, because it's merely giving them the alternative of coming to the United States if they are granted their application, but also presenting them with alternative countries. These individuals do not want to go to Spain or to Brazil. They want to come to the United States.
Interesting. Renata, what about, now you mentioned earlier that it usually takes up to 12 years or might, and in an outset, take up to 12 years to get an adjudication here. What kind of reboot would we need with manpower and facilities and money dedicated to try and get that time frame down to something manageable? Are we looking at having to completely revamp the system? Are we looking at hundreds of millions or $1 billion to do this? How do we do that?
This is a great question. I read a report today that the Orlando Immigration Court, which is not even the largest immigration court in the country, has over 130,000 pending cases divided between eight judges. There is no way that with the current infrastructure that we have, that these individuals will be processed in a timely manner, both for the United States and for the migrants. There has to be a happy medium where the United States is allowing individuals to claim asylum, number one, abroad. There's no reason in my legal expertise that these individuals cannot apply for asylum at the embassies and consulates abroad, that they cannot pay a fee that can be waived on a case-by-case basis so that we avoid these incredible backlogs that do nothing for the government and for the safety of the United States. And most importantly, migrants are coming here at most to protect their lives and to work. But the reality is we need migrant labor, especially in industries like construction and landscaping, to the most, to the highest level of individuals in medical care, in education. We need to find a better way that does not involve only creating backlogs and demonizing immigration to the United States, but that also makes sense for the American taxpayer.
And you know, Renata, I feel for an immigrant who comes here and they get in and their case, as you say, is going to be adjudicated, but because it's so long, because as you say, it's 7, 8, 9, 10, 12 years, I mean, imagine living and setting down roots in this country and, as they say, keeping your nose clean, paying your taxes, loving your new life here, and you get to 5, 6, or 7 years not knowing if in another 2 or 3 years you'll be forced to go back. I mean, just that aspect alone is unfair, I think.
I believe that the United States has always been a place where people from all walks of life came here to start new and to thrive. So what is the justification to send away someone who is now a successful business owner in the United States, employs hundreds of individuals, contributes to the community, pays taxes, has American kids? It's just inhumane. But also, it is not beneficial to the United States to remove these men and women of working age who want to work in positions that we need filled. So it's a matter of how long for are we going to keep our head in the sand and avoid resolving the issue just for this political hot potato that's not helping the United States. No matter where you are, on which side of the aisle, neither Republicans nor Democrats have presented a solution that works for all of us, not only immigrants, but for the everyday American who will feel the impact of a reduced workforce in the United States. So it is unfair to the migrant, but most importantly, it is not taking seriously the needs of the United States of today.
And Renata, finally, you just kind of took the words out of my mouth here. When you mentioned Democrats and Republicans, Renata, I can almost guarantee you, and you know far more about this than I do, that if you took Democrats and Republicans and got them away from the spotlight and put them in a room and shut the door and turn the mics and cameras off and got them away from their donors that funnel money to the base, they could probably figure something out here. That's my guess.
I wouldn't be surprised. In fact, two of the largest donors of political campaigns are the private immigration jail operators, GEO Group and Civitas. They are incredibly profitable. Why? Because mostly migrants are crime averse. They want to come here and work and stay out of trouble. That's not to say that 100% of migrants stay out of trouble, because that would be statistically impossible. You're dealing with humans.
Mm-hmm.
But why is it that an immigration jail gets to say how their profitable business of incarcerating people for an immigration violation gets to continue? This doesn't work for us. Our schools need money. This money that's being funneled into immigration detention should be funneled into things that make sense for America. And America needs people working. America needs an immigration system that is fast and fair. It's not to say that we're going to have open borders, because that is also ludicrous. We need a happy medium, and America needs to go back to a time where we could have a discussion based on facts and information and taking into consideration what works for us as a country, irrespective of political affiliation. When America wins, all of us win.
All right. The website, CastroLegalGroup.org, CastroLegalGroup.org. You can get information on our guest and the services she offers there, Renata Castro. Renata, good to chat with you again. We'll chat down the road. Take care and enjoy the summer.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye. There you go. All right, folks. CastroLegalGroup.org. Imagine that, 12 years to adjudicate an immigration case. 12 years. And any kids you have here, remember, the kids born here are, you know, American citizens here. And there are some allegations on one side of the aisle saying, well, the other side wants as many migrants here because it's more voters for them. Then the other side, the Democrats, fire back at the conservatives and say, well, all you big business owners, you like all this cheap off the books labor. What was it, about a year, year and a half ago, they found a couple of meatpacking plants? Was it in Iowa or Kansas somewhere? Slaughterhouses, for lack of a better term. Like, the top three or four guys or gals there were U.S. citizens, and everybody was basically off-the-book migrants. Oh, my God. Checking in right now, our weekly midweek check-in. We put it on the fulcrum, the balance. Wednesday, middle of the week, away from the first 2 days, heading into the last 2 days. Dan Haar, Hearst, Connecticut media columnist and senior editor, is joining us once again. Dan, good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon. Everything is good on a Wednesday afternoon, I guess.
That's right. You know, another great week in the great state of Connecticut. A lot of stuff to talk about, Dan. Now, what is it? Is COVID over in Connecticut? Is the virus now turning away? What's up with that?
Well, I guess we are at endemic stage or less, certainly not a pandemic, and nothing really changes. This is the federal government announcing back in the winter, and I believe February, that on May 11th, the emergency was going to end, and Connecticut has duly ended the emergency. I don't know whether Connecticut had an option of maintaining the emergency after the federal emergency, but it's irrelevant because we're past the point mm-hmm. of an emergency. And this essentially means that the biggest change for us as residents is that vaccinations and treatments will be part of your regular insurance and may cost you money. Tests will no longer be free, although there are going to be some free tests, still given out, but there won't be like it is now, where you can get as many as you want free of charge, although people have been buying them. So really, in terms of our day-to-day lives, relatively less of a dramatic change. And the governor and the old team, they were calling it, you know, Old Home Day or Old Timers Return Day
yeah.
at Yale. They all got together, Josh Jabal and Paul Mounds and Max Reese and all the folks that were there, Dr. Albert Koh from Yale, and they did a little bit of a, it seemed like a bit of a victory lap on how well the Connecticut did. Of course, there were many deaths in Connecticut.
Sure.
Nobody is forgetting that as well.
Yeah, and Dan, I certainly hope. And again, this was, we hadn't had anything like this, Dan Har, for 100 years. I mean, you had to go back to the, you know, the flu pandemic, 1918 to 1920 and thereabouts. You know, gosh darn it, Dan, I hope we learn something about this because, you know, it's going to happen again eventually. We don't know where or when, but it will. And as you said, there were deaths. A lot of those were nursing home deaths, older people, just the way, surprise, the experts said there would be. And I certainly hope we learn something from it.
Well, yes and no. Connecticut lost 13 or 14% of all nursing home residents. And that is, of course, one out of every seven. At the time, as of the time of the start of the pandemic, about one out of every nine died right within 3 months. Mm-hmm. And then since then, there have been more deaths, but at a much, much slower rate. And so, yes, that's tragic. And, you know, you could say, yes, you learn, but with each new crisis, you learn something different. I looked at the records from the 1918-19 flu, the so-called Spanish flu, really mm-hmm. not the Spanish flu, epidemic or pandemic. And Connecticut's 65% of deaths from that pandemic were in people of middle age, not older.
Wow.
People who were older specifically did not die. So, you know, and obviously there have been many outbreaks of many infectious diseases since then. And you like to think that you learn more with each one, but each one brings new challenges. And in this case, I continue to think that the state allowed too many people in and out of those nursing homes. But what could you have done to stop that? You know, you needed nurses and assistants coming in and out.
Yeah.
And that obviously is where some of the spread happened, but what were you going to do?
Absolutely. Dan Har is the guest. Dan, we also got a kind of a sobering report from a legislator who was killed in that wrong way accident on Route 9 coming home from the, you know, coming home from the governor's inauguration facilities. You know, Dan, it's a sad reminder of a little bit of an issue that legislative leaders have had to deal with and people deal with in general is the use of alcohol when you're getting behind the wheel, and just a sobering and sad story adding on to an untimely death.
Well, that's right. And what makes it all the more difficult is that Representative Williams, Quentin Williams, who died the victim of a wrong-way driver mm-hmm. going home that night at 12:45 at night from the inauguration, it does appear no one has actually seen in the Capitol. Even the governor told me today when I asked him the question, he had not seen the toxicology report.
Mm.
So no one has seen it. But we're getting word that it says that Representative Williams was over the level of intoxication that was allowed. And we don't know the number, but it's unfortunate. What people are saying is that that wasn't the cause of his death. And so we hope that it doesn't sort of, you know, mar his legacy. But as you said, precisely, it raises the issue. I am in the camp that says that there's no more or less of a problem of drinking in the Capitol than there is in the rest of the population. And there are people who, prominent journalists, one blogger in particular, who seems to believe that it's an endemic problem in the Capitol, and I don't see any evidence of that.
All right, and finally, the Republican budget. We don't get one of these too often. Dan,
no.
It seems to me that every time they elect a new pope, we actually may get a Republican budget document, but we have one. And the Republicans, Dan Har, are kind of agreeing with the governor on some stuff. There may be strength in numbers. What do you make of this whole thing?
Yes, today's release was from Senate Republicans. House Republicans released their budget last week. They are similar. The tax cuts from the Senate Republicans, as we expected, are the largest of all, $1.5 billion in tax cuts. And so they're basically taking all of the options and throwing them in. The largest, they agree with the governor about the half-point income tax cut for the middle class. They want the income tax cut to be retroactive to this year,
mm-hmm.
so that throughout, when you file your taxes next year, you'll get that return for this year. And that would be a few hundred dollars for most people. They also want a $2,000 per child tax cut. I'm sorry, tax deduction.
Yeah.
That's and so if let's say you're paying at a 6% rate, that $2,000 would be worth $120, if I'm doing my math correctly.
Okay.
And so that's not insignificant. They also want to eliminate the much hated over-the-road tax that truckers pay, which has problems anyway, but they're having problems collecting it, as the Republicans warn, $90 million a year. They're going to get rid of that. And they're going to pay for a lot of it by not filling vacant jobs at the in the state agencies and hope that, that the state agencies can just continue to operate as they have. The pushback from the agencies will be, we can't do this. We got to fill our jobs.
Dan, have you gotten too much blowback off your column from a couple of weeks back? Like, if you're going to give me a tax cut, give me a real tax cut. The heck with this $100 or $200. How did that go over?
Apparently, everybody agrees with me. Certainly all the Republicans and Lamont and all the moderate Democrats. It's the more progressive Democrats who want to see a smaller tax cut who disagree with me. And, you know, everybody is free to disagree. Obviously, there is a consensus for a full half-point cut in the state income tax at the middle-class level, at the 5% level. And that's the way it should be.
Do you get stares, Dan, when you walk down the halls of the Capitol, or does everybody still smile at you?
No, I have close friends among the progressives because
okay.
I support a lot of the things that they support, namely more money for social service providers, the nonprofit providers. The problem is that I got another call today from yet another group that's looking for money, and then the sky is going to fall if they don't get, in this case, $30 million. And how could we not pay $30 million to, in this case, it is the community health care centers? Because they need it, and they're all right, but there isn't money for everybody. That's the problem.
Yeah, and Dan, I know people that work for those community centers, and they do great work. Boy, Dan, finally, we went from a few years ago not being able to pay the light bill and looking under the couch for coins, and now we have this huge surplus, and everybody's banging down the door. It's amazing how quickly this can change.
Oh, the perils of having a big surplus, everybody banging down the door, is obviously a better thing than having to cut agencies. But the effect with inflation ends up being the same because we have a spending cap, which you and I don't want to talk about right now, but suffice to say that we are limited in how much we can spend even though we have the money. And so the cycle goes round and round. Unfortunately, a lot of that money goes to paying down the pensions. And as we saw a report yesterday in our papers in Hearst, from Jeffrey Sonnenfeld, the Yale business professor, Connecticut has not done too well with its investment returns in the last 5 years. So, you know, we're spending a lot of our surplus building back up a fund that should have been built up by the economy and wasn't. So it's a tough place to be, but
Dan,
a good place to be.
Dan Haar, Hearst, Connecticut Media, columnist and senior editor. Dan, thank you. Have a great week, and we'll talk next week. Thank you, sir.
Middle of the week.
Thank you, sir. Dan Haar right there.